Welcome, my friends. Welcome. This is a special episode. Storyteller, a woman who has been an ecological activist for many, many years, defending trees. She's an important message for us about trees. Since it's nature's way, let's go ahead and bring you that first interview. This is with a confirmed ecological activist, a wonderful woman who has fought to defend Florida's wildlife, Florida's trees. Let's call her Ruddy.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to welcome a wonderful person who has been involved in the environmental movement for many, many years, an activist, an earthling, someone who believes very strongly that we must speak up for the earth that we live on. You've been involved in so many good things. Ruddy, what have you been up to lately? What do we need to know?
Hi, Rick. It's wonderful to be back on your show and wonderful to hear your voice.
Well, thank you. It's our pleasure.
Thank you. So one of the pressing things that's not getting very much attention at all in mainstream media or even our independent media outlets is this draft environmental impact statement that's been released by the USDA. This statement came out April 20th, and it is considering the deregulation of a corporation called ArborGen, their genetically engineered eucalyptus trees. And so I've been on your show before talking about the dangers and unknowns about genetically engineered eucalyptus trees, that after 6+ years, the USDA finally released a draft environmental impact statement. This is, if it's approved, which is what the draft environmental impact statement suggests, is that it does get approved for commercialization. This will be precedent setting. It will be the first genetically engineered forest tree to go through the deregulation process and be deregulated, and will open the door for other trees, genetically engineered trees, to be approved through the federal process.
For people who aren't aware of some of the issues that have been raised in the past by genetically engineered crops, we've seen nearby farmers sued. We've seen the drift of pollen from these genetic engineered plants. And so that people understand, this is not what used to be referred to as hybrids or hybridization. This is not grafting one plant into another. This is literally re-engineering plant or animal material with different genetic codes, sometimes quite unusual pairings. What can you tell us about what they're trying to accomplish with this genetic modification to the eucalyptus trees? Is that something you can address?
Yes. The eucalyptus, without being genetically engineered, is the most commonly planted plantation tree in the world. it is desired because it's fast growing and it is a key tree for the paper and pulp industry. The eucalyptus is grown in Chile, in Portugal, small amounts here in the U.S., mass amounts in Brazil, and many places in the world. It's native to Australia. So what ArborGen has done is it's genetically engineered this high-tech hybrid eucalyptus. It's a mix between Eucalyptus grandis and Urophila. It is genetically engineered for freeze tolerance. So it can survive in climates that it has never survived before, and its grow range can be expanded. Eucalyptus, wherever it is in the world, has a tendency to be invasive, highly water-sucking, impacting the local community's water sources, and also highly flammable. The Chile, our winter, their summer, had some of the worst forest fires and fires in their history, and that was exacerbated by tree plantations that abutted communities' homes and went straight through communities, killing 11 people and damaging tens of thousands of homes and properties. And in Portugal, over 60 people just died through these intense wildfires that were exacerbated by eucalyptus plantations. And so ArborGen, understanding the industry, that eucalyptus is a key tree for the pulp and paper industry and also a tree desired for the future biofuel and biomass industry, and current for the biomass industry, is trying to expand its range so it can grow and have these impacts in places that it's never really been able to survive before and still grow relatively quickly. It's also genetically engineered into the eucalyptus sterility and its male sterility. But the problem is sterility has never been successful in genetic engineering, ultimately because in genetic codes, every species wants to survive and procreate and thrive, and so it almost always pushes through that and is able to flower and spread pollen. And aside from that, without the sterility being engineered into it, eucalyptus themselves can stump sprout, and they have not stopped it from stump sprouting. And so even when the eucalyptus tree has been cut down, it's going to grow back and potentially get into other plantations, potentially flower. And for folks that aren't aware, breathing, the testing isn't there in terms of the impacts of pollen, genetically engineered pollen, on humans. And some scientists have equated it to being the same as ingesting GMOs. So the impacts of how we're actually, as humans, are going to interact with the environment is not there.
So we have a situation where there's a global water crisis, and these things take up more water. We have the increasing temperature rises, increasing threat of massive fires. And, of course, all too often, our government, with its modest wisdom, tends to outsource testing to the very companies that are looking for approval. So I think we can probably say this is a potential really massive problem. You had mentioned in the past that there is a chance for the public to provide input. Can you talk about that for a few minutes?
Yes. Right now, it's really critical, especially people in the Gulf South and the Southeast, to submit public comment, especially against the commercial release of these genetically engineered trees, demanding that there isn't enough testing and that even the test plots be retracted right now. It is the action area that's in the environmental impact statement is over 200 counties in the Southeast, and that includes Martin County, Brevard County, Okeechobee County, Highlands County, Glades County, and most almost all the counties north of those counties in Florida, as well as Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, South Carolina, and Georgia. And so it's critical that people get their comments in as soon as possible because the deadline ends on July 5th. That's coming up really soon. We're also looking for organizational sign-ons. We have an organizational sign-on letter. We have over 60 organizations, and we're trying to get 100, hopefully 500 organizations to sign on to a letter opposing the commercial release. And folks can go to stopgetrees.org to find the petition to sign, or they can go directly to the USDA website to submit their own public comment. And if folks want to sign on to the organizational sign-on letter, they can contact me at ruddy@globaljusticeecology.org.
So obviously, from what you're telling us, this has a tremendous impact across the South. You know, this is not one of those problems, people, that it's affecting, let's say, rainfall in Antarctica or the decimation of glaciers. This is right here in South Florida and across the South. So you have a frog in this fight, unfortunately. So we need to speak up. Ruddy, has the Sierra Club taken a position on this, or are they still considering?
I am not aware of the Sierra Club's position, but would love to be informed of their position on it.
And I guess it's probably pointless to ask if the Audubon Society has gotten up off their embroidered chairs to address this issue either.
I'm going to follow up with them, but I am not aware that they have taken a stance. Right now, we have the Center for Biological Diversity has put out a petition. The Center for Food Safety is the lead on the organizational sign-on. There are many organizations that are participating, large and small, but we still don't have enough and enough voices from a variety of different constituents and to explain and demonstrate how many different people are going to be impacted by this. And so it's not just a rural fight. Also, it's both rural and urban. The counties that I mentioned surround Lake Okeechobee, and the Everglades bioregion is vast. I think I've mentioned this before, but we're looking at Melaleuca 2.0 on steroids for Florida. And if eucalyptus escapes and it's genetically engineered and it gets into our Everglades, this could be the final straw. And so we can't have that because we need the Everglades for our survival. And so this is a bad deal for everybody involved.
Let me ask you one more organizational question. Has Food and Water Watch has taken some pretty strong anti-genetic engineering stands. Have they signed on?
Well, Food and Water Watch is in support. I can't confirm that they've signed on, but I believe they're going to.
Yeah, they've been real good about trying to rein in some of this wild genetic experimentation. You know, a lot of people misunderstand the term as is typically applied by bio businesses. When they think of genetically engineered crops, they're thinking, oh, you're making it more nutritious. You're making it more vitamin enriched. You're helping the minerals. God, you're making the plants stronger. Typically, though, what they don't realize is when they bioengineer a lot of food crops, all they're doing is making them more resistant to, let's say, Roundup and similar pesticides and herbicides, not for the good reason that they can use less of it, but for the very point of them using more of it. So essentially, this genetic engineering of a lot of food crops has amounted to an open door to even more pounds and pounds and pounds of this chemical abuse.
Absolutely, and it's only getting worse. I think another thing on a more systemic level that people should be fighting is the Bayer and Monsanto merger. They've been systematically killing people for the last decade, many few decades, since before World War II, Bayer especially. And as we know, Monsanto's been creating chemical weapons and killing people since Vietnam. So, and with their release of PCBs, these are two corporations that are going to profit heavily off of the continuation of GMOs. And these big agribusinesses, once they consolidate, they're probably going to gobble up corporations like Arborgen and push more crops, food, animals that are genetically engineered and somehow profit off of our, I mean, I want it to be a conspiracy theory, but the facts are there that they profit off of the destruction of human life and ecosystems.
Well, not to mention the fact that Monsanto now owns its own private army. What used to be called Blackwater is now part of the Monsanto family of death dealing.
Yeah, the lines are getting clearer and clearer with where these corporations stand.
You've been working to protect the environment for a long time. You know, I almost hate to mention it, but that wonderful, strong stand so many environmental activists took to try to protect the native forest alongside 95, the corporations won. And every time I look at that massive scar and think of the forest that used to be there, it just makes me so terribly sad. I'm sure you must have the same reaction.
Yeah. As you know, Rick, I was working to save the Brigger Forest since 2010 through citizen surveying and also direct action. We not only did a tree sit to raise awareness, but we occupied the offices of Coulter, the group that has been actively destroying the forest. Also blockaded the entrance to construction when construction was underway about 2 years ago. And we actually are in the production phases of a documentary highlighting the fight that we've had against Scripps Biotech since Mecca Farms in the early 2000s all the way to now. And they have won to a degree, but we are still fighting and we're going to be trying to save the West Side. And so probably in the next month or two, folks should keep an eye out to see the documentary that we are going to be releasing on the fight to save the Brigger Forest and also how folks can still fight to save the West Side.
You know, I had an experience last fall that I think may bring a smile to your face, an ironic smile nonetheless, but a smile. I was at a conference, and a gentleman stood up, and he was giving his perspective on a water issue. And ironically, for a brief cycle, their interests aligned with ours. This was in terms of subsidies for Big Sugar, and he was speaking against it, and he was with the Heritage Foundation. And I asked them a question that I've been dying to ask conservatives for a really long time. I said, "Excuse me, sir, when was it that conservatives stopped believing in conservation?" And he looked at me like, "Oh, my God, I got one of those." And he said, "Well, I don't really want to talk about that." And I said, "I can imagine why not." I said, because once upon a time, you know, conservatives felt that we should conserve the land and the water and that the development should be kept in check. And in fact, the whole idea of zoning was about preventing the abuse of the land and the water. I said, so you're presenting yourself as a conservative who's really only interested in you know, stopping a dollar leakage. I'm here about another leakage entirely, about the leakage of our natural resources into the pockets of the greenmongers.
Right.
And needless to say, I don't think he got the joke, but I was talking to a Trump supporter about a month back, and I said, so, okay, you've experienced a few months of this gentleman, and so do you still like him? I mean, is he still the best thing since sliced bread? And he said, oh, God, oh, yeah, oh, my God, yes, he's doing everything that he said he would do. I said, let me ask you a question. I said, I will admit it, I mostly talk to progressives. I was going to say wild-eyed radicals, but I didn't want to damage his ears. I said, I admit it. I hang out with liberals. I hang out with progressives. And we really think quite differently. I said, but I got to ask you a question. I said, you're a reasonably intelligent fellow. I've always believed that. I said, so, have you ever enjoyed like a national park? He goes, oh, my God, yeah, the parks. Oh, my God, the parks are just so great. I mean, they are really just, I just love to go camping. I said, well, do you know that, Trump and his pals are selling off the national parks? They're going to put oil derricks in and uranium mines in the Grand Canyon. And he said, oh, well, that's not so good. I said, okay, all right, let me ask you this. Have you ever, walked along a stream and, looked at the little fishies and the froggies and the salamanders? Isn't that kind of cool? He goes, oh, I love that, love that. I said, well, do you know that Trump and his pals have just said to the coal companies and industrial producers alongside rivers and streams that they can just go wild? They can dump anything, anytime, no questions asked. Huh? All this cumbersome regulation is history. He said, well, that's not so good. I said, let me ask you one more. Because but don't you think it's great that we have a much better relationship with Russia now? And I said, I think, with two great world powers, if we can de-escalate the finger over the button, yeah, that's good. I said, but let me ask this. Do you think it has to come at the expense of, like the allies that we've had for, 60 years? Is that part of the equation? He said, well, that's not such a good idea. I said, but you really like Trump, huh? Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. He's just fantastic. I said, so other than the air and the water and the trees and the plants and the rivers and the streams and our allies, other than that, he's just a hell of a guy. And he didn't get the irony either. But listen. you're doing such good work. How can people who want to help, protect the forest, protect the green spaces, how can we, where do we need to go to find information about the release of the film? Tell us how we can support the projects that you're working on.
I'll just re-mention with the GE Trees and then the project with the Brigger. So if folks want to sign the petition, they can go to globaljusticeecology.org and go to the Take Action section. And if folks want to sign on organizationally, contact me at Ruddy, R-U-D-D-Y, at globaljusticeecology.org. And with the Brigger documentary that we will be releasing, we have some updates to the website, but it will be on EvergladesEarthFirst.net. And look out for, it should also be on Palm Beach County Environmental Coalition's website. It's going to be produced by Palm Beach County Environmental Coalition. Thank you, the Lush Company. They provided the grant for us to do it. That right now, I think, is the two main things.
Well, thank you so much, Ruddy. You're doing the work that so many of us would love to spend more time doing. I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing the information that you have. When the filming is completed, the edit's completed, and you're ready to release it, please come back again and we'll talk about it, and maybe we can find some way of hosting a showing or something, okay?
Thank you so much, Rick. It's wonderful talking to you.
And likewise, an honor to speak to you, my dear. You're fighting for all of us. Thank you.
We all do our part. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Progressive News Network, a new Mercury Media production, where you'll find the voices of activists, the voices of those working to make this a better world. We believe that as we face challenging times, the human spirit can face and surmount the foolish and the short-sighted. Tune in every Sunday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, for the live show, or anytime you can. Progressive News Network, found at www.newmercurymedia.com/PNN/. We have a future. Tune in and build it with us. Underwritten by Florida Media Labs, produced by Rick Spivak in cooperation with Canary and a Coal Mine Films. Progressive News Network. And now, our second interview for this PNN special. Happy Indian Independence Day. I want to thank you for joining us. And no matter when you're listening, we want you to know that Progressive News Network presents the voices of activists, scientists, and artists.
Daughters of Isis is the ancestor of aromacology, indigenous scents representing the fragrant memories of our ancestors, to provide us the tools of the inner quest, the authentic moment, and to heal the Earth Mother. DaughtersOfIsis.com. Wholesale available also. Mention PNN and enjoy a free sample from our apothecary. For your aromatherapy needs, that's DaughtersOfIsis.com.
And now, an interview with Annette Tadeo, who is running for Senate District 4, State of Florida Senate, and here she is.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to welcome tonight Ms. Annette Tadeo, who's running for office in the great community of Miami-Dade. And Annette, tell us, what office are you running for?
We have a special election in Senate District 40, which is in Miami. It goes from, those that are familiar with Miami, goes from 40th Street all the way to 200th Street. And it's pretty much the entire western portion of US 1. So the biggest area of the district is Kendall, which is obviously very, very big and very populated I feel a forgotten area of Miami-Dade County. Elected officials.
really, absolutely. It is, that's a large area with lots of different neighborhoods in it. And I know you've been a Dade resident for a long time, so you've seen lots and lots of changes. What are some of the most important issues in this, what we hope will be your future district?
Well, we are in the western part of Miami-Dade County, very populated. The traffic is something that is so essential, or a big complaint, I should say.
Sure, sure.
Of the residents, and I've been knocking on doors. We've actually knocked on almost 10,000 doors, and it's only been a month.
Wow.
So I'm very proud of that we are truly going door to door and making phone calls and going straight to the voters. And I can tell you their biggest issue is transportation. It's just they spend so much time in traffic. The tolls are prohibitive and numerous. As someone who ran for lieutenant governor and has been all over the state, I can tell you, in other parts of the state, they don't even, the state of Florida, they don't even have tolls. We have not just tolls, we have tolls that are very expensive and in numerous different roads, especially for those that have to come all the way from the west towards downtown to go to work. So this is a major issue. People spend way too much time in their car trying to get to work, even taking their kids to school. Politicians love to promise things, love to sell us pretty packages, and Miami-Dade County has been tremendously affected by that. I remember I was a leader in the, as you know, and some of your listeners know, I'm a businesswoman, and I And I used to be, I was elected as the chair of the Coalition of Chambers. So 22 chambers in Miami-Dade County combined elected me as their chair. This is a long time ago. But the reason why I'm telling this story is because, you know, all the politicians came to the business community, to all the different organizations, to all the different groups, trying to convince us about, you know, taxing ourselves to improve our traffic situation, which we all said, absolutely, let's do this. We need to invest in making sure that we have the, you know, a proper transportation system. And what always happens is you are told all these things, but then they turned around and used that tax that they have been collecting, but they used it for maintenance and not to extend our light rail that we were supposed to get, especially in the southern part of Miami-Dade County. So it seems like, yet again, we're going through this again now, trying to figure out what kind of funding are we going to get from the federal government, what kind of funding are we going to get from the state for us to be able to have the infrastructure and finally get an extension of light rail. And again, we're being told, well, you guys come later. We need to take care of this other area first. And it just seems that the residents and the doors I have knocked on are absolutely fed up with it and fed up with the lies and the promises. And there's no one truly fighting for them on that. But there are many other issues, obviously. That are important. One of them that is top as well is education. People are really fed up with the number, of legislators, specifically from our area of Miami-Dade, who, you know, get elected to represent the residents, and either they themselves or their relatives have jobs with the for-profit schools, the charter schools. And I tell you what we saw this year with the amount of money that is being taken out of our kids' public education to go to a for-profit school is criminal. I mean, it is just, to me, it's amazing that we are allowing this. It should be illegal. You should not be able to profit and vote off of, you know, it's to me, it's like the people I speak on the door, it's like a no-brainer. A conflict of interest. Either you work or your relative works for one of these companies. You cannot, therefore, be there drafting the legislation, making sure the budget is humongous for your pocketbook, and then turn around and vote for it. I mean, that is just insane. And I think what I've seen at the doors is the voters are absolutely upset, fed up with it. This is not a partisan issue. This is an issue of the education of our kids should come as number one, and it does not. And it's been just, you know, special interest after special interest, electing certain people to go to the state legislature and, you know, work for them as elected officials. So I'm going door to door. I'm knocking on the doors, and I'm saying, I want to work for you. And I'm doing something that I don't know of anybody that has done it, but in my door hanger, and the pamphlet that I give everyone at the door is I give them my cell phone. I really want to work for the people. I don't care to work for those that don't need representation. They have plenty. What we need is somebody that's going to fight for hardworking folks that just want their kids and the economy to do better and everybody to have an opportunity. So that's why I'm running.
It always seems strange to me how people could be sold a bill of goods. If there's X amount of money to be spent on schools, how does it make sense to also extract a profit element? It has to leave less money there for the schools. I know when I lived in Dade County in the late 90s and early 2000s, traffic in the Kendall area, traffic coming from South Dade, the largest, growing residential area of the county, the traffic was horrendous. It could take an hour to get from Western Kendall to Eastern Kendall. And then, with the addition of the expressways that dump onto US-1 has been a nightmare for decades now. I was recently in Miami, and at 7:30 or 8 o'clock, I wanted to go from Key Biscayne down to Coral Gables, and it took over an hour. And this is way past what you might normally call rush hour. You know, how the impact this must have on commerce, on business, it's horrendous. And, you know, I don't know where all those toll money's gone to and all that tax money's gone to, but it sure hasn't been invested in actual building roads, has it, or mass transit.
No, and let's remember that a lot of these boards that manage that are appointees of politicians, and, you know, they all have friends that get contracts, and it's just the corruption is beyond it just makes you sick if you start thinking about it. But I, rather than get sick, I just get going and get fighting, because we cannot just continue to allow our state to go in a spiral, downward spiral, as we don't pay attention to, you know, to what these elected officials are doing. And throughout so many years, and there's been zero balance because it's been complete Republican control. And look, we're not immune. I'm a Democrat, proud Democrat, but we're not we have our bad apples too.
Sure.
Well, I'm not going to say that that we're all perfect, but certainly I think that one of the reasons why I feel that this race is so awesome, and I feel so good about it, and it's a very winnable race, is because it was born from the people, from the ground. The way in which it became an open seat with, you know, my state senator at the time, Artiles, saying such nasty words and such disrespect towards African Americans, towards women, and then blaming it on us Hispanics, saying, oh, that's just the way they talk in Hialeah. It was just like one thing after another. We were just like, excuse me. So the way it happened was unfortunate. But at the same time, it was beautiful to see the community together, regardless of race, color, language, coming together and saying, you cannot represent us. You have to resign. And it was those same community leaders that did that then turned around and said to me, we need you to run. And I, Richard, I have to tell you, I was not expecting to do this. This is the last thing I ever thought I'd be doing this summer. My daughter's now out for summer. And here I am knocking on doors and, oh, God, I don't even know what I think it's 94 degrees outside. So, you know, I didn't think I was going to be doing this, and this is not something that I would have ever guessed that I would be doing, but it is so humbling and different. And you know, I've run before, but you know, we always have these consultants and people that love to have a horse in a race, and they make money off of races and all that stuff. And you know, after you've been in this a while, you get to know those calls. This was not those calls. This was truly the leaders in the community, the people, I mean, the African-American pastors calling me, those kinds of things, that I've never seen that. And to me, that was extremely encouraging. And I said, you know what, instead of me listening to these consultants that always try to get you this way or that way, I'm going to listen to the people that I've been wanting to represent. And that through all these years, I've been active in the community, and they know me well. And it's just really, it's been an awesome experience, truly people-driven campaign. And it has, I just this morning had a breakfast, and there were like 70 people there. I mean, I'm just, you know, we one Saturday was pouring down rain, and 34 people showed up to knock on doors in the rain on a Saturday. I mean, it's the kind of things that I have not seen at other campaigns. So in Miami tends to be a place that, you know, there's so many things you can be doing and people are busy. And it's really a hard place to gather crowds and to really get a lot of volunteers and to see this kind of excitement for this race. has been very, very humbling. And it's a huge, of course, incentive to just keep going, keep knocking, just knock on a few more doors. And the response has been unbelievable at the door as well, where people now know my name very well. And it's nice to see that the name recognition is there, and not just recognizing my name, but actually in a positive light, knowing me as a fighter and somebody that refuses to quit. And something I learned from my dad, the fighter pilot, a long time ago, the closest right to ever, ever stand in the sideline, on the sideline.
Well, when actually is the vote going to take place?
Richard, it already is. People got their absentee ballots this week. So we already have, people that have voted. And since they have my cell phone, it's really nice. A lot of them call me to let me know they just mailed it. We'll have early voting. July 15th is the first day of early voting. We will have it for 10 days. And then our election day is July 25th. That is for our primary. And we feel very, very good based on the response. And it's going great. We just got endorsed by SEIU, got endorsed by all the different, the Progressive Caucus. That was an awesome endorsement, as well as AFSCME. Another big union, and
well course, deserved.
Yes, we also have the communication workers, and you know all these different unions that are helping out and you know adding to the group of volunteers that I was just telling you about. It's nice that we're going to have all that, but it's very much it's very much run with a bunch of volunteers, pretty much, which is really nice.
Another question that has to be raised in the South Dade area, in addition to transportation and education, there's increasingly a greater and greater concern about water resources, about the effects of climate. When we think about Miami-Dade and the large mass of population there, very few people stop and think about where all the water comes from, where all the waste products are processed at. You know, these things tend to be out of sight, out of mind. There is an increasingly vocal part of our population that is concerned about these things. I'm sure that you're among the concerned people who are worried about what's going on with the climate, what's going on with our water resources, how we handle those. Let me ask you this. As you think about these issues, and we still have, unfortunately, a very conservative Republican legislature up there, what do you think a Democrat in the legislature, how can we as a minority group still have a significant and important impact in the Tallahassee legislature?
That's a two-pronged question, but I will tell you that is one of our top issues as well that I didn't get to mention because we are seeing it every day. I mean, we're seeing sea level rise in Miami, and it is not something made up. You can come and see it yourself. When it rains, the actual water doesn't floods our streets, and it is a major problem. And so I'm going to answer your question from the point of view of it doesn't make business sense, and it doesn't make economic sense for us to ignore it. We pay in South Florida specifically, and I'll tell you, I know all over Florida, but in South Florida specifically, a humongous amount of money for our insurance on our home. In addition to that, this community depends tremendously on real estate as an economic engine. When banks banks usually are about 20 years ahead of time, thinking ahead. And when we see insurance companies and insurance become prohibitive, and banks no longer giving mortgages because they're concerned about the fact that a lot of the area is going to be underwater and the infrastructure, we have done nothing with our infrastructure to prevent what is coming, and we know it's coming. So this is an economic issue. This is not just an issue about liberals, you know, tree huggers or however they like to call it. It is an economic issue, and we better pay attention to it because it will affect the houses that so many people, their only asset. The banks will not be able to we will not be able to get mortgages. So that is my argument. I know there's a tremendous amount of data economically as to why we should be doing preventive measures. There's so many things that we can be doing. And think of all the job creation, right?
Right.
To be able to elevate certain areas, to do certain things that we need to do. Now, you also talked about how does this affect our drinking water. Tremendously. We already have a problem in Florida specifically and in South Florida with the saltwater intrusion. And I know that our wars of the future are going to be all about water. And if we don't have water, then that creates all kinds of problems with how do we grow our food. And, I mean, there's just so much that we have to just be long-term thinkers. And we are only thinking of right now and the profit and who's making money. And we are not electing people that are actually thinking long-term. Because, of course, they're always worried about their next election. And I think that there is a tremendous conscience with the voters, at least what I'm seeing at the doors, where people are really quite concerned. And when I tell them the economic issue, they get it. They get it. And so I think that that is the argument that I would take, even as a minority. This is the argument I have taken for many years. As you know, I used to have a TV show on CNN Latino, and I've debated lots of these legislators, Hispanic ones from Miami on TV. And one of the reasons why they always are trying to stop me from being successful in any election is because they're aware of my capabilities of fighting with arguments and economic arguments, where it becomes very difficult, and also that I like going straight to the people and getting them on board. Look, I've never held an elected office, but I've won some very key battles in our community. And I'll just give you one example. In our community, in 2012, we were so excited. We got Barack Obama reelected. And right after that, immediately after that, the owner of the Dolphin Stadium hires all these Democrats, that work for the Obama campaign, and because they want to pass a tax and they want the taxpayers to pay for a new stadium for a billionaire, mind you. And so I, at that point, was the chair of the Democratic Party in Miami-Dade, and I said, no way. I have not spent the past, year and a half talking about the importance of reelecting Barack Obama and how we cannot have corporate welfare so that we can then turn around and look the other way so that we can have a stadium. I'm not against a stadium, but don't use my tax dollars. We already did that in Miami, and we're still paying for it with the Marlins Stadium. So I started that movement and fight and went to the media and held town halls where I invited the people from the Dolphins so they could tell us why it was such a great deal, like they said. And I had my arguments. And then I went on Spanish radio and Spanish TV, and lo and behold, they lost and we won. So, you know, I you know, obviously don't need a title to be effective, because I know that the way we're effective is we teach the people. And we explain to them what the arguments are for and against, and people are not dumb. But most of the time, politicians don't go to the people and just, you know, come up with slogans and lots of money in campaigns. And I really believe in the power of the people and talking to them. And I believe in town halls. I believe in answering questions. Heck, I even give my cell phone number. So, you know, unfortunately, we've got way too many that are elected that hide behind lots of layers.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things that I find just so wonderful about you and your campaign and what you're going to be able to do for Florida is that, you know, you're not just a person who understands the issues at hand, who speaks to people, not just corporations and the guys that write checks, but to me, the fact that you have been a communications professional, you understand the importance of the exchange of ideas, of listening as well as talking. That, to me, that special skill in communications makes you qualified like a few other candidates I hear. You have to tell us how we can support you. Let us know how we can get behind you and help get you elected. You need to be elected.
Yes, and this is a race that we can win. By the way, the Democratic ticket for president won this seat by almost 20 points in this last election. The Democratic ticket, which I was in for governor, Charlie, Chris, and myself, we won it by 11. So this is a seat that we can definitely win. And we should be excited about this tremendous opportunity with the special election. The way to help is obviously if they're in this area, volunteer. Also, go to our website, AnnetteTadeo.com, donate. Every little bit counts. I chuckle when people tell me, oh, I can only give you $20, or I can only give you $40, or $10, or $5. I'm like, well, that multiplies. And if you let other people know, it multiplies. I love that I have so many, you know, donors that are just giving whatever they can. That, to me, is much more special than any kind of humongous check that one person can give me. And I think that people can help in many ways. So one is vote with your pocketbook. The other one is your time. Even if you are not in Miami and can help us knock on doors, we have virtual phone banks. So just let us know, and we will hook you up with the virtual phone bank so that you can contact voters. Because remember, since it's a special election, we have to let a lot of people know that there's an election going on. And the only way to do that is to call them, mail to them, and knock on their door. So that's at least how we're doing it when you're running a people-powered campaign. My cell phone, I am going to give it out. It's 305-801-5873. Again, it's 305-801-5873. And that is the cell phone I've had forever. So I'm not changing it. And if I do not answer, because I don't carry it with me when I'm knocking on doors, please just leave me a message. Send me a text message. I will respond. And I can't thank you enough for giving me the opportunity. And I hope that lots of people all throughout, anywhere, you can help. You can put your grain of, you know, of sand so we can leave an imprint in Florida with better representation, because it's time.
Best of luck, Annette. Absolutely. We are pulling for you, and I hope a lot of people donate to your campaign. I'll be making my call today. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, have a good one. I'm going to go knock on doors.
Go ahead. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
The Rebel Girl, Joe Hill dubbed Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, and a song the martyred labor organizer wrote about the fiery Irish-descended woman who was one of the courageous labor organizers and radicals of the 20th century. Born in Concord, New Hampshire in 1890, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn drank in rebellion with her mother's milk. Mother was an ardent suffragist. Father was right beside Elizabeth when she was arrested for the first time at the age of 16. Flynn's family was one of millions sweating out a miserable existence that only the strongest and luckiest survived. The family was finally able to move into a decent apartment in the Bronx, and it remained headquarters for Elizabeth for 27 years. It was an era of few amusements the poor could afford, so Elizabeth joined one of the many debating societies. They cost nothing. She made her first public speech on January 31, 1906, under the auspices of the Harlem Socialist Club on what socialism will do for women. That same year, Elizabeth joined the Wobblies, the radical and colorful industrial workers of the world, and began the most intense and productive years of her long career as a labor organizer. "My first step into the trade union world," she says in her autobiography, "occurred in 1908 when I was invited to speak to striking longshoremen." She was very much involved in to prevent the railroading of three men accused of murdering the governor of Idaho. Like so many women in the labor movement, she crisscrossed the nation. Train trips were long, uncomfortable, and dirty. Organizers could seldom afford a sleeping car. Women had to contend with corsets, long skirts, and the disapproval of traveling alone. However, with her IWW comrade, she felt as safe as if I were in God's pocket. She attended the IWW convention in Chicago when she was just 17, barely old enough to put up her hair and let down her skirts. Her history during those turbulent years was virtually inseparable from the heyday of the IWW. The militant union was organizing many thousands and giving bosses much cause for heartburn. One of Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's most important organizing effort was her time in the volatile Mesabi Range of northern Minnesota. Workers struck because their lives were nasty, brutish, and only too often short. It was during this time that she married a miner, Jack Jones, and produced a son, who was reared mostly by her mother. Nothing could stop her. Whether it was the Mesabi, the massive Lawrence, Massachusetts strike of textile workers in 1912, the frame-up of Tom Moody and others in 1917, the murder of Wobblies in Everett, Washington, the huge steel workers' strike of 1919, Elizabeth was there. Like millions of others across the world, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was dazzled by the Russian Revolution of 1917 and joined the Communist Party. During the hysteria of the McCarthy period, she paid by spending 2 years in a federal prison. Tune in next time for the life of Margaret Dreyer Robbins. Songs for the Unsung is a project of user-friendly music, script, narrative, and original music by Joanne Foreman, sung by Jenny Bird.
Well, thanks so much for tuning in. This has been Progressive News Network. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.